Hello and welcome to Social Creatures. I'm Kat Anderson, and this is the show that explores some of the most captivating success stories on social media. Today, I'm chatting to Alfred Samba.
I had to learn that it wasn't about what I wanted to say. It was more about what the community wanted to hear and understanding how they interact with each other and mirroring them.
Social media is a space for anyone, and really, nearly anything goes. But what is it that propels an account to the summit of success or popularity? Three seasons in, and I can honestly say, every story is unique, unpredictable, and fascinating. And digging into the why behind these stories is exactly what we're here for. Throughout the series, we'll be talking to the brains behind some of the best accounts that you know, and hopefully some that you don't know yet. And new to this season, I'm going to be chatting with influencers who've achieved staggering success on social media, who are at the top of their game, and who are setting the trends. How the heck did they do it? Together, we'll uncover the way brands, organizations, and individuals have carved out their niche in the vast landscape of social media, and how you can do it too. As the former social media executive at the global fitness brand Gymshark, Alfred Samba is widely acknowledged as playing a pivotal role in propelling Gymshark from a community of 1.5 million to 20 million in just 7 years. This played a critical role in helping the Gymshark achieve its unicorn £1 billion valuation. As their 24th employee, Alfred was assigned the task of expanding the community, and boy, did he succeed! In spring of 2023, Elf embarked on a new venture, founding Butterfly Effect alongside co-founder Michael Heaven. Their agency specialises in guiding brands through the intricate landscape of marketing, with a focus on expanding community engagement. Renowned in the industry for his exceptional talent in captivating diverse audiences, Elf provides profound insights into the realm of branding, enriching both individuals and organisations alike. I am a huge fan of Elf, and honestly, every single time I've seen him speak, I've heard nothing but gem after gem of wisdom come from his mouth. I have no doubt today will be any different, and I look forward to seeing what gems he'll share with us now. So, Alf, I am so excited to have you, the king of social media marketing, on the podcast today. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. That's a pretty big title, but hopefully I can deliver on it in this conversation.
I mean, I don't think I've ever called someone the king of social media marketing before, but I do think it is appropriate for you. Maybe, though, you could tell us about how did you get the crown of being king of social media marketing? How did you get into this field?
I'm going to treat that as an unofficial crown. Throughout my whole career, I thought I was going to be a doctor like my dad. And then I realized that I was terrible at science and I had to find something else. After we moved to the UK, we felt that the possibilities were endless. And the iPhone keynote delivered by Steve Jobs changed my life forever. The way he was able to storytell and really articulate some very complicated information in a very simple story was the thing that got me really hooked on marketing in general, because I realized that whilst everybody was leading with IQ, he was focusing on EQ. And I realized that people that are able to distill some really complicated stuff into very simple stories are the ones that are going to win going forward. And then obviously to connect with my friends back home, I used an app called Facebook. And then I found out that Facebook was founded by this 23-year-old called Mark Zuckerberg, who turned down $1 billion from Yahoo. That got me really excited. And then even more excited when I watched The Social Networker and I learned more about his journey. And I said, you know what? We're going to live on social media in the future. And after studying marketing, I realized that with product, place, price, and promotion, place doesn't necessarily have to be a physical space. It could be online. I wrote down a dissertation theory about the fact that I thought small to medium-sized businesses would utilize social media as an equalizer to help them dethrone their larger competitors. It was marked down because of lack of Harvard references.
Oh.
My whole journey was to become that reference. After going interview to interview and getting turned down by the corporate gang, a company called Gymshark allowed me to actually turn theory into practice, and here we are today.
I really love that story. And particularly what I like about it is there's a commonality of you being inspired by Mark Zuckerberg and the fact that he was young when this was happening with Facebook. And similarly for yourself, you were young when this was happening. So you've just said you've just finished your dissertation. You're fresh out the oven, ready to hit the world of work. You're coming in with all of this theory. And as you said, you joined Gymshark and you're famed for taking that community from 1.5 million to 20 million within 7 years, which is wild. This is probably still now like what you're most renowned for. For anyone who hasn't heard about this journey, can you tell us about what happened there?
I was given the keys to the Gymshark social, not kingdom, but the responsibility of leading the lines from a social perspective. And before I joined, Ben, who's the founder of Gymshark, was the one that was actually posting on the channels himself. So it has a big trust factor. But then, like I said, I was a theorist. So initially, I would come up with ideas that sounded great, made a lot of logical sense, but then in practicality, just didn't work. I had to want it to say, it was more about what the community wanted to hear and understanding how they interact with each other and mirroring them. Once I understood that that is the most important thing, we came up with a very like replicable blueprint that can be applied to different audiences, which is why when we went from actually focusing on the Gymshark main account to growing Gymshark women, we're able to apply the same philosophy. And then since brands outside of the fitness space, the same philosophy reigns supreme. Listen to your audience, figure out how they interact with each other, and then make sure that you mirror them and demonstrate that you understand that you mirror them and demonstrate that you understand their pain points, which is why people like Dude with Sus seem to be like, he's living in our heads. That's exactly what he does. There's also another TikToker who is an ex-NBA player, or I think it's a G League player, who pretty much creates like these relatable videos about people that do certain things and people just seem like they hit the mark. All they do is they're great listeners and they build a blueprint around the psychology of a particular audience, and then they just seem to feel like they're so relatable.
The concept of understanding your audience and mirroring them, is that about being relatable? Is it about showing that you're listening? Is it about understanding them? But maybe it's a combination of all of those points, like taking the time to, instead of just come in and throw your products at them, you're actually maybe taking a bit of a back seat to listen for a while. Does that sound about right?
I guess the mirroring aspect is more about relatability. So people like to surround themselves or get drawn to people that are like themselves for the longest and the individual. So first and foremost, it's about making sure that people feel like you get them, because people are now using brands as almost like a way to express who they are. And if you're able to demonstrate that you're somebody that understands them, that's your first in to understands them. That's your first in to building a community. At the one tier above that, which is value. Just mirroring them or just regurgitating what they're saying or how they're thinking is the basic level. But then really you have to understand what the pain points are behind those statements. And if you're able to demonstrate that you can go one further and actually unlock barriers that currently exist or relieve pain points, either through your products, through your experiences, then you're starting to go to a completely different tier. People don't even do any of those two steps. They just focus on, I've got this product, you need to buy it now. And then the third tier is when you start to be almost like the spokesperson for a community by standing up for things that the community believes in. You have to understand the conversations that are happening outside of your product, your industry, but within wider culture, and see how you can successfully integrate your business or S community into wider culture as well.
Just in the spirit of keeping with our conversation of understanding the theory and the practice sometimes being a little bit different, can you give me some examples of how you did that, like across those three tiers?
I'll give you the example of Gymshark Women. At the time, the male side of the business was about 95%, revenue-wise, follower-wise, etc. And the company wanted to make a big shift and really grow into the female market. But one problem, when we first started, there was no females that worked for the brand. It was like a bunch of young guys, all from a 5-mile radius, that really loved fitness clothing, loved lifting heavy weights, but didn't really understand the female experience, especially the female gym experience, which is part of the problem, right? So representation is super important. And you have to make sure that the people within your team actually represent the audience that you're trying to tap into. But with the understanding that you have to tap into the psyche, And Gymshark Women famously was going to be shut down because we're just not resonating with women.
Wow.
So I said, just give me a couple of months and I think I can turn this around. And what I did was I just studied the people that were in our comment section, the fitness influencers, how they communicated with themselves, how they communicated with each other. And I realized that this polished content that all our larger competitors were posting, or this, we go to the gym every day, 7 days a week, kind of like Mr. Motivator undertone, was just not working. People wanted to feel like the brand was a best friend that was into fitness. I wanted to almost like inspire you to go along with them. Once you understand that that's exactly what they want, the content type completely transforms. It's not just about me in the gym. It's the pre-experience. It's the post-experience. It's the outfit that I'm going to be wearing. It's the experience I'm going to be having. It's the feeling that I'm going to be going through whilst I'm going into the gym. And once you just package that red thread, you're able to like build a whole tribe of people that align with that. And that was mirroring and studying and going audience first. When you think about the whole notion of campaigns, I just feel like big hero video campaigns with violin music trying to tell you an inspirational story is very redundant. I think that people see through that. And even if you think about what was happening at the height of COVID, there was more statements made than ever before. And what people have realized is that the best brands lead with action. If you genuinely care about your community, or you have the audacity to believe that you want to create one, you also have to show up when other people don't. What Gymshark always did is, whether that be Black Lives Matter, whether that be COVID, whether that be International Women's Day, it always leads with insights and action. So not getting involved in conversations that have nothing to do with us, but understanding conversations that are existing within culture and figuring out what the gym and fitness spin is to that. And what can we actually tangibly unlock aligned with that? I used to always say that the world is much bigger than Blythe Valley. For those that don't know what Blythe Valley is, that's actually where Gymshark's offices are located. And if you're located over there, you're pretty much secluded from the rest of the world. So you almost believe that Gymshark is everything. Once you take a step out of that and you realize the conversations that are happening around the brand, you're able to figure out how you can interject into culture. So whenever something will be happening or trending virally, we'll always say, how do we Gymshark it? So what's our version of that? How do we get involved into the conversation and bring people into our world? And that's the only way that you can grow a scalable brand through social.
I love that. And I think it makes so much sense. We hear people saying that all the time, like getting involved in conversations that actually are relevant for you. Like if you don't have something to say, don't, because people can see through it. But I think you articulated that so perfectly. One other thing you mentioned there was that when you were looking at Gymshark Women, you were looking at influencers as well and other like fitness creators online. Gymshark is really renowned for really pioneering influencer marketing. Can you tell me about how you noticed this as a huge opportunity? Obviously, you know, plot twist, we know you were right. It's massive, but it's pretty interesting that you really were at the start of this. So I'd love to hear that journey. What did you see and why did you go, this is something we should do?
The synergy between myself and Gymshark was almost like an equal balance. The team were like way ahead of their curve. I was thinking about this, but they were doing it. They were doing social. They already had 1 million followers when I joined. They were doing influencers. And it's just because it just felt right. It's something that they did every day and it just made a lot of logical sense. Ben talks about the fact that instead of watching your Mr. Olympias or your athletes on TV, he was spending his time on YouTube learning how to like build his physique, learning how to eat the right things, learning how to wear the right things. And he said that actually, if these guys that I look up to would give me some feedback on my clothing, that would mean the world to me. So he sent them clothes for free that would give them tips of how to improve the product, etc. And they just listened. And then eventually over time, they kind of like fell into influencer marketing by just being genuinely curious and asking for help and wanting to connect. And then they obviously brought everybody to Body Power Birmingham. Whilst everybody else had these big names, they had this collective of this new school YouTubers that just amassed this large audience of people. And they realized they were onto something there. And now going to me, obviously they understood how to build influencers within the bodybuilding space. Now I had to figure out what is the thing at the core of that that can be retrofitted to any other industry. And it sounds very like dinosaur to think about it in 2024, but in 2015, the conversation was around the fact that women shouldn't be going to the gym because they'll look like men.
It's so true. That's wild to think now, isn't it? I remember that. Like, you'll get too muscly, you'll look too masculine. That's so toxic and mental.
100%. And I think that people forgot that before Gymshark and the seamless collections and everything, it was almost like a no-go area. And we realized that actually, if you can bring some early adopters that have been able to maintain that energy whilst adopting this new hobby, and you make it as part of a lifestyle that's actually been seen as cool. Like, people are stylizing their gym wear. People are like actually not just going to the gym just to lift weights, but it's actually becoming a part of their life. Even if you go to YouTube back in the day, Gymshark unboxing videos didn't exist. People unboxing fitness wear didn't exist. So tying that to fashion and culture was one of the big things that we wanted to do. We said, actually, what are other industries that are doing this very well? Be that music, be that fashion, be that tech. And let's take some inspiration from those industries and apply it to ours. And that's how it got greater connected. I always tell people that whenever you're looking for inspiration, don't look at your competitors. Look outside of your industry, because that's where the magic is.
I love that you're looking everywhere. You're looking at competitors, you're looking at other industries, you're looking in theory. I feel like you're water in a bucket. You know, you're touching all of the sides. Do you see that in yourself?
My obsession is consuming the current state of culture. I like the idea of staying in the field and understanding what's happening today. I like speaking to my nephews and my siblings about like, what are they consuming today? The nuances between the fact that you know that naturally there's gonna be a change of the guard because the younger audience wants something that they own, something that represents their generation. And they're trying to figure out when that pattern is shifting and who's leading the charge. I feel like the issue with not just the marketing world, but just in industries in general, is that people get very comfortable with used to work in the past. And we have a bit of an evolve or die mentality, right? We always used to say that our biggest competitor is not going to be your Nikes, your Adidas, your Pumas. It's going to be the next 19-year-old Ben. And my goal is to find them and bring them on board. And that's what I've always looked out for. When you think about how I built my teams, it's always been about one, I would look at my brain and dissect it into different areas where I focus, be that the theory, be that the content, be that the disruption, and I'll actually get people to own those areas in greater detail than myself. So I can keep on floating, and then when I catch something, I get somebody to drill down. That's how we built our team. So if you think about the four main sections within our team, it was channel, so people that looked and obsessed at all the different channels. We went from people looking after five channels to three channels to like two and sometimes one. So you'll have somebody that just focuses on TikTok. Their goal is to be the best brand on TikTok. And we really went to town in making sure that we understood the intricate detail that came with the platform mechanics. Then we had the community team. Their role was all about proactively and reactively interacting with our community and being there where they didn't expect us to be. But then taking that insight back to the business so we can make more informed decisions. I think we actually once asked people, if you were Ben Francis, what would you do in the next 5 years? And we would take those ideas and would actually execute on them, right? So I think a lot of people use social as an opportunity to shout, but really it's a hearing aid. And if you listen closely, it'll give you all the answers that you need to make the right decision. We had Disruption, Connor, who actually works at Butterfly Effect now. He was my disruption lead. So making sure that he was not infiltrated by the day-to-day happenings of the social team and the business, and they were just looking out for what's happening. That's why Gymshark was first to market on TikTok. That's why whenever something new comes about, like a Discord, Gymshark is always first. When Clubhouse came in, myself, Noel, the CBO at Gymshark, and the team were just hopping from like chat to chat, just listening to why this is going to work. So we were just active practitioners and really excited about when new developments happened. And then we also had our own social production team that bridged that gap between creativity for the sake of creativity versus what actually makes practical sense from a social standpoint, and making sure that we're creating that elevated content as well. So it was just my brain kind of like broken down into four things. And I just got people that were way better than me to go into the detail. And then we just moved very, very fast.
You mentioned the butterfly effect in your answer. And so even though it sounds like you and Gymshark were like fish and chips, salt and pepper, a match made in heaven, you decided to leave and create your own agency called The Butterfly Effect. Can you tell us a little bit about what inspired you to make that move and what is The Butterfly Effect all about?
First and foremost, I found out about this thing called the Ikigai Theory about finding your true calling. It's basically like a questionnaire that's a framework that's broken down into four different sections, and it asks you, what are you passionate about? What are you good at? What can you be paid to do? And what does the world need? And I realized that Gymshark ticked off three of those points, but the what does the world need? I don't think the world needed more gym wear. It just needed better gym wear. But then I think that that story of women at the gym was done, an inspirational young founder was done. I felt like actually I needed something else to get me out of bed instead of just like doing the same thing. I often describe it like Hermione during the Prisoner of Azkaban, when she had that like time when she could go back and said, I've seen this before, yeah. Right? It just felt like an endless loop. And going back to comfort being the enemy of progress, I said that I needed to figure out a bigger problem that would keep me up at night. So I went to Cannes. I didn't mention this at the start, but before I joined Gymshark, I actually was in the agency world. So I didn't really get it then because I just felt that the best brands are built every day, not campaign to campaign. I just felt that the idea of working in-house and optimizing and building your own in-house agency actually made a lot of logical sense to me. And that's what Gymshark did. When I went to Cannes, I was like, well, this world hasn't changed. I've been away for 7 years and it's still the same shape. And I also looked at who was there. And long story short, it just felt like the people that I felt were like the best in the industry were not represented. And I was just there like, do you know what? I know people that can really shake up this industry and can really do some really great work. They just need a platform. So why don't I create a platform where I house the best creative and marketing talent into one house, and we're going to help brave brands become famous. And that's the whole butterfly effect that we want to create, is the uniting of the best diverse talent and removing the friction with brave brands and then helping them become famous. And it's starting off as a full service agency, which has been doing really, really well. So first 12 months, we've worked with the likes of McDonald's, Cheesecake Factory, Netflix, Bumble, Square. It's been pretty awesome considering that we're punching well above our weight in such a short period of time. But our ambitions are much bigger than that. We really want to, like we said, if we're going back to the whole goal of removing the friction between diverse creatives, brave brands, we think that it's going to gradually evolve into more of a democratization of creativity, right? I'm not going to reveal too much of that, but in stages, it's going to be a full service agency, being able to help people build their own in-house agency, and then eventually being able to have Butterfly Effect and myself in your pocket. So that's probably like the best way to kind of like think about it.
Oh, that's exciting. And what an unbelievable roster of clients for your first 12 months. Are you crazy? That's amazing. Congratulations. Like, you must be really happy with how it's going so far.
Do you know what? I think that everybody always sends me there's a Kobe Bryant meme. I think somebody's asking him, why isn't he happy or anything? Because they were like up on the like playoff series. And he said, there's nothing to be happy about. The job's not finished. Our ambitions are way bigger than that, right? Like, we love and we are so happy that we get to work with some awesome brands, some awesome people. But then until the job's done, which is removing that friction and really changing the perception of diversity and representation and demonstrating that it makes business sense on a global level, until that is done, I don't really think that I'm going to be very excited, right? So it's almost like an ever-chasing loop. But then for the team, for reference points and for people that are on the journey, that's the most exciting thing about where we are right now.
I can understand that. And I think even from this conversation, hearing about why you decided to leave Gymshark, it's probably good for the way your brain works for this to be something that you are constantly always running towards the horizon, you know, because you need that challenge. Something that you have been known to talk about are the four levels of marketing when it comes to especially social media marketing. Creativity is the first level, but could you tell us a little bit more about what these four levels of marketing are and explain it to our listeners?
I used to tell people it'll take me just a few seconds looking at somebody's CV to know whether they're the wild card or not. Whenever we used to put job ads out at Gymshark, even at Butterfly Effect, today we'll get like 2,000-3,000 applications per role. There's some non-negotiables, maybe like three questions that we ask so that we can actually get that list down to maybe 200. But Once we've done that, I look through every CV, and I still do this today. It's the most important part of my job because I feel like that's where a lot of people trip up. They think it's all about the strategy that you put in place or the plan that you make, but it's all about the people that you have. And I realize that there's four levels of depth that a person needs to have to be able to function in like a business model that we're trying to build. And it can be replicated in different industries, but I'll focus on the social space for now. It's almost like an iceberg. So at the very top is creativity. So I don't actually think that you have to be that creative to be great at social, but I think that it helps that you have a variety of different references that you can draw on when it comes to problem solving and coming up with like ideas, right? And then it's all about the understanding of platform mechanics. That's the algorithms, the changes, what people want on TikTok versus on Instagram. I think there's a famous Dolly Parton meme when she pretty much put a picture of herself in four different spaces. And she said, this is me on Facebook, this is me on Tinder. And if one person is four different people on different platforms, then you can never have a one size fits all strategy. And we need people that understand that. So they understand that it's a context play, not a content play. Whilst creativity is great, context is key. Once you know that, that's like your entry point. Now, if you want to get into the house, an understanding of psychology is super important because those two things change. Reference points and what works from a creativity standpoint changes. Platforms change. But then what doesn't change is people. And if you understand how people work and the fundamentals behind their desires, what they think about, dopamine levels, all those different things. So I look out for anybody that did any form of psychology. That's the first thing I go for. I'm like, I can see your creativity. You worked in social, so we'll put that to the side. Have you understood or studied people before, right? Or have you demonstrated that you're curious about people? Because if you can do that, then you can train to apply that to any canvas that you want. The final one is all about the understanding of social dynamics, which a lot of people don't really think about. And what I mean by that is that's the difference to why a Ryanair can get away with certain things that British Airways can't. Same industry, people think it's the same consumer, but then actually they're tapping into different social groups. The best way to articulate what I do is like Pharrell Williams, the producer, who's able to produce a song for Gwen Stefani, but then also for Snoop Dogg. Yeah. You have to be able to understand who the end audience is so that you can make sure that you can get the best out of it. And a lot of people can do that for one industry or for one audience, but they cannot take themselves out of the equation, change and learn their filters and apply that to a completely different audience. Now, those are the people that are worth gold. If you can do all four, you are literally sitting right next to me and are figuring out where the world's going, right? So that's what I look out for.
I love that so much. And I just wonder as well, just to like even go further into that, as someone who yourself, you've had tremendous success in leadership roles, what are the qualities then that you're looking out for leaders? So we want all of those four levels covered for a leader, but are there any other tangible things that you're looking out for a leader?
I think that there's two different types of leaders. There's leaders that lead by execution or by example, and there's leaders that actually love managing people. One thing that I realized is that there was a time at Gymshark where you'll have these really young, great people that could execute and they were responsible for the business, like getting quick out the blocks. But then reality kicks in and now they have a mortgage to pay. They want to get married. They want to almost like just evolve or elevate their life. And the only way that they can do that is if they go from being this practitioner at a very high level to being a manager. And I was like, well, that's a completely different role. You're almost like saying, I'm really great at this thing. I'm going to change to this thing that I really don't want to do, but I have to do it because it'll help me fund the life that I want to live. And my whole philosophy was, do you want to be a coach or do you want to be the captain, the person up front? Do you want to lead by example or do you want to help create other leaders? And I feel like different people are motivated by different things. And our goal is we need to understand the type of like bucket you want to fit into. And we pretty much created a structure where you've got people that help manage people and people that grow within their career based on what they execute, right? It's almost like in martial arts when you have belts. So you can equally grow your career and not be almost like shunned because you don't want to manage people. Like, why would you ruin that superpower? So I try to understand at the base level, what type of leader do you need to be? Because we need both, right? And I think Satya Nadella uses the example that A great team has the perfect balance of energy and clarity. So you need your energizers and you need your clarifiers. You need people that will get you really excited, wanting to run through big walls. They'll bring in new inspiration that lights people on fire. And then you need people that are basically like, guys, we know what we need to do. Here are our deadlines. Here's what your responsibilities are. And I think that if you can get that balance right, then you'll do really, really well. So when we hire, and even if you look at the structure that I set before, those four teams, perfect balance. There was community and channel, which were the clarifiers. So anyone that led those teams had to be clarifiers. And then you had disruption and production, where there was your energizers, right? And then within their teams, they need to have that perfect balance as well. It means that you're able to know what you need to do, but you're actually creating things that are so far-fetched that other people don't see. And if you weigh too much on either side, it either becomes very vanilla or you just get canceled, right? So we did that. And then, but then one thing that I always say is, now the role of a leader should be that they should operate like a sports coach. You should only be able to inform what happens on the field before the game, at halftime, and at the end. If you're putting on your boots every single time something messes up, then you're not a coach. You're basically a substitute. And I think a lot of leaders love to be needed, and they feel like they demonstrate that value by getting involved, but really that's showcasing that your plan doesn't work. So my role is to find people that want to be coaches as opposed to glorified substitutes, really.
Oh, it's so refreshing to hear somebody thinking about leadership in that way, between, I guess, really pushing people into people management, as you said at the top of that, or honing your skills and your craft and becoming a leader in the form of an IC, basically, you know. I do think it's changing a little bit now. I don't know if you agree. I think some companies are realizing we can't just push people who want to progress in their career into people management, because that doesn't always equal progression for a lot of people. And that's where you get bad managers. But I love how you think about that. I think that just sounds so inspiring. And I hope our listeners are inspired as well. Something you said before we got into this chat about people, you talked about how you used social data and what was going on social media to help inform your product choices. And I know from seeing you talk before and also from talking to you before, Elf, that you firmly and passionately believe that social data and social media should not just be something that is of concern to the CMO, but this is something that should be of concern to the CPO, to the CFO, to the CEO. This is something that everybody should be feeling passionate about in the company. And oftentimes, let's be real, that is not the case. Can you tell us why you believe this and why this is such a hiccup for all of these CEOs and CFOs who are not looking at what's going on social media?
We always used to say that as soon as it goes from being Gymshark versus the world to Gymshark versus Gymshark, that's when we're in trouble. And often than not, when you look at the dynamic between people in the creative and marketing space versus people in the finance, etc., there's no respect for one another. Maybe as people, yes, but from a profession standpoint, the social and marketing guys are just the guys that come up with crazy ideas and spend the money. The finance guys are the people that don't get us, and legal's trying to hold us down. One thing that I understood when I first joined Gymshark was, at the start, everybody understands social more than 95% of the global population, because they're all young. I like to simplify what business is, and I see it in two camps. It's the way that you make money and the perception that's associated with the way that you make money. And that's all it is. And there's subsections underneath that. The finance, COO, CEOs, they care about how the business makes money. But we need to tell them that what we're doing is not trying to put our ideas out there. We're trying to shape the perception that's associated with that, because that will allow us to make more money going forward. I'm also part of the leadership team, and I need to make sure that what I'm suggesting is built on credibility, not just my personal perception. So the first team that we got in place was the social listening team within the community team before we got anybody in the content side, because I wanted to make sure that we're basing everything on insight. I think Jay-Z, famous philosopher, often says that men lie, women lie, numbers don't. We've always based everything that we did, from creative campaigns to social content, on the numbers. We look at the numbers, we articulate the numbers, and then we add our social fluff into it. And then we storytell in a way that doesn't get lost in translation. But then people understand that. You're not talking about the gray. You're saying, well, everybody is posting selfies in our hashtags looking from the left-hand side. So product team, put the logo on the left-hand side, right? So it's about just looking at the numbers and then adding a creative layer on top and just making sure that it makes logical sense. And if you can aim to educate the team on the left brain to understand and see things from your lens and why it makes logical sense, then you'll actually get closer together. And what tends to happen is people are too proud to say they don't understand. So once you get them to understand, then they'll let you do what you need to do. And I think that's the best way to sell marketing to your CEO, is by getting them to understand what it is that you're doing and demonstrating the dials that you're shifting, and then they'll be on your camp. Long-winded answer, but I feel passionate about it.
Totally. No. And I just wonder, do you think how brands in the time that you've been in this industry have effectively, successfully evolved with how they're using social media, or is there still a long way to go?
I think one thing that I said about Butterfly Effect at the start was we understood that our audience is brave brands. We're not for everybody, unfortunately. Whether you're big, small, whatever, you have to be brave. The reason why we're able to get such an exciting client roster in 12 months is because they're brave. So if you're brave, then we have commonality and we can start to learn, unlearn, test and learn and go forward. But if you're not brave and you're just trying to maintain your position or not lose your job, or if you're more concerned about not losing market share than gaining market share, if you're always looking at a lens of how do we not do something, how do we prevent something from happening, then unfortunately, you're just waiting for somebody to out-innovate you and take you out of business. That's just how I personally see it. I think that for businesses that have been able to maintain that position for years without changing anything is because nobody was curious enough to disrupt your industry. As soon as somebody says, do you know what? I'm going to go to the unsexy industries where no one's looking and I'm going to create a brand there, that's when you're in trouble. That with where the world is going and the fact that AI technology is going to allow people to stepping into industries that they probably couldn't have the resource for in the past, that's where other industries that are untapped are really going to feel it. And especially with all the layoffs that are happening, all these people are going to go somewhere. So there's going to be a lot more smaller indie brands being created, taking market share away from all these big players. And then they're going to really start to regret the fact that they didn't evolve. I still think it's preventable. But then I just feel like inherently a lot of people are not very brave.
I think that's so interesting. And it's such a true observation. I think a lot of what you're talking about does skew in favor of smaller companies and younger people. Because I think if you become more tenured as a company, you know, you've got more to lose. And similarly with people, you know, like people get more afraid of taking those risks. And I kind of can understand it, but I am totally with you that I think that the dividends of being brave, and I think people conflate being brave as the same as just being risky. But have you found that there is often that confusion where bravery equals risky? Like, it's not the same thing, right?
Not at all. We always talk about taking calculated risks. Here's the thing, and you heard it from me, I'm actually not that creative. I just have so many reference points. I could do algebra and complicated maths before I could even write in English. I'm more insight driven because I know that that doesn't lie. It's like behavioral psychology at scale, how people behave in a macro. You cannot deny that that's how it's all based on facts. And then you add a creative layer on top of it. I think what I do not agree with is when people go into a dark room, come up with an idea and force it onto the world. That just doesn't work. So if you're listening to what's actually happening and you just do what people are telling you that they want, then it's actually not being brave at all. It's just being logical. It's not a risk. You're not risking anything, right? You're just going towards the tide. And the issue is that a lot of people want to ignore that the tide is changing. They're like, well, no, we're not going to look there. Well, if somebody tells me, and this is what actually happened when we found out about Musical.ly, which later became TikTok, is that Gary Vaynerchuk was yelling about this platform called Musical.ly. And people talk about platforms a lot. And whenever I hear, I go onto the app store, I look onto the free section, I see an app ping-ponging up to the top, I'm like, I need to look into that. And I need to see, why do people like it? Is it just we're trying to be the new Instagram? or does it mean something to a niche community that everybody else finds weird?
Mm-hmm.
And that's when you find the next thing. And also, does it relate to an audience of the future or the mindset of the future? So when we went to Musical.ly's WeWork back in 2017 or 18, something like that, there was four people in it. And they basically told us that we have this app that has 70 million 13 to 20-year-olds or 18-year-olds or something like that called Musical.ly. And I was like, oh my God, this is the future. That we allowed it to get to 70 million people and we haven't even found out about it. I realized then that I'm getting old, not old by age, but old by mindset.
Right.
I allowed myself to get comfortable with what is working today, that I completely ignored this tidal wave that was coming. And we pivoted. I got myself and an intern. We jumped onto a TikTok, and then we became the number one brand on TikTok because we just moved fast. And the rest of the company were telling me, don't focus on TikTok, double down on what we're doing right now. But then I was like, no, this is where the future is going. And then when they found out that we were actually on TikTok was when the article came out to say that Gymshark's the number one brand. What happens there is I realized that the concept of getting old is not about our age, because everybody was still in their mid-20s. It's about that psyche of not wanting to unlearn and rewire and update your software.
I love that. And it kind of leads into something here that we, in this season of Social Creatures, we are trying to get our audience more involved. And so ahead of every episode, we are asking a polled question on our Sports Social channels. And for this episode, Alf, we asked the question, the future of online communities will be all about either one, huge numbers, or two, smaller private groups. Now, I'd love to hear what your thoughts are on that. What do you think the results will be?
I always say to people, we're going into the niche era. And if you think about the smallest niche, if your audience was only reflected 1% of the global population, that's 80 million people. So instead of trying to be the most popular, find your 1% and double down on them. You can create a pretty big business, right? You can create a pretty big audience. So people are now finding commonality on shared topics of interest. And I feel, going back to your point, it's going to be smaller and more intimate, but with greater depth. Because right now, in a world of surface level, people are yearning for great conversations, deep conversations, that are learning to be able to connect with people. That's why podcasts are doing so well, right? So I feel like that's what we're going into. It's going to be the niche era, but then it's not so niche because it's actually pretty big, but you're going to actually be speaking to people that you have commonality with and you want to connect with. So anybody that's able to bridge that or remove the friction between great conversations and people, that's going to be the next social media platform.
This isn't going to surprise you, Alf, and it certainly didn't surprise me. You are 100% on the right side of our poll results. So we had 11% of people thinking that communities are still going to be about large numbers, but a whopping 89% think it is about exactly what you're describing, those smaller, in-depth, more niche communities. Like, I think you're absolutely bang on with that. Alf, this has been amazing. And my final question for you today, and I'm so interested because I feel like you've already answered this in so many different ways, but we've asked everyone on this season, do you have a swear by strategy or rule that you've noticed is consistently effective to successful posts on socials? Something that you swear by that you can leave with our listeners today?
I'll give you two. I can't give you one because they both need each other. I think that if you prioritize context over content, once you get that right, that sets you apart more than like 60% of other marketeers out there. I think that a lot of people are saying, I'm going to do this campaign first and then I'm going to share it everywhere else. No, you should say, I want to get this message out. And what's the best way to get that message out on all these different platforms? That very simple thought process changes everything. So when you understand the context is the game and not content, then you can create great content. And then when you're now starting to think about what content should I be creating, and we were speaking to Gary, who's the founder and CEO of VaynerMedia and a crazy internet personality, someone would say that he's the godfather of social. The best way they articulated it, it was in my brain, but I didn't know how to articulate it. And they said that there's two different types of businesses or two different types of creatives. There's be right creatives and businesses, and there's find right creatives and businesses. What be right creative businesses do, or creatives, is they sit in a dark room, come up with a really great idea, try to push it onto the world. That used to work back in the 60s because no one could afford to be on primetime TV. No one could afford to be on the radio. And if you could afford to do it and you can push your message down, that was the minimum requirement. But now where everything is so fragmented, noisy, and competitive, you can't do that anymore. You have to go out into the field, listen to what people are saying and what they want, and then you figure out how you deliver that for your business. And effectively, the best way before a trial and tested strategy, if you want to know whether your campaign is right to go on the Super Bowl ad, is you first do a poll and you ask people questions and you see what is the hook that splits the audience and gets people ferociously backing a camp. Then you turn that into a meme and then you see whether that still hits. Then you turn that into a skit and see where people still like that. And then eventually you're like, okay, cool, we've done this, we stress tested this enough to the point where we know that people will not ignore it, people will say something about it, and people will offer their opinion, and it creates positive conflict. So it's more likely to go viral, right? So by the time it gets to the Super Bowl ad, you've A-B tested it so much that when it goes to the world, you know you're going to get widespread conversation. And that's how people do it. You can't say, well, we have a Super Bowl slot, what are we going to do on it?
Yeah.
Right? The Super Bowl slot starts from the start. Like, you test it where it's free so that when you pay for it, you know that it's going to work, right? And that's what Gymshark always did. Before you invested production dollars or paid media dollars into anything, you tested it in a place where it was free. So the Twitter account, here's a golden nugget. Gymshark's Twitter account is the first touch point of what you can potentially see in campaigns in the future. It's, let's put a tweet out there that's in line with how fitness people think and see which one people resonate with the most, and let's build from there. So it's not about how big the Twitter page is. It's a red thread to the language that we use across the whole of social media, because it's free and it's conversational and people will give you honest opinions. We're not scared that people might say, this is lame. We need to know that, so that we don't create something that's lame and pay for it, right?
Yeah.
So you may as well know that for free, then pay for the world to tell you that.
Yes. I mean, Elf, you're still the king of social media marketing at the end of this conversation. These insights have been gold dust. Thank you so much. I feel like I've just sat back and soaked it all up. And I'm sure our listeners will feel exactly the same. Thank you so, so, so much. The king of social media marketing, Elf Samba.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Social Creatures with me, Kat Anderson. Many thanks to Alfred Samba for joining me today. And a huge thank you to Sprout Social for making this podcast possible. If you enjoyed this episode, make sure to let us know on social media at Sprout Social, and be sure to subscribe to hear other episodes like this wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks very much for listening, and we'll see you again in 2 weeks.